go ahead now. Welcome to the Sunday Night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. This meeting is being recorded, so you may visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The link will be posted in the chat. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive overeater, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. I would like to welcome Joe M., a compulsive overeater from Minnesota. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, thank you, Donna, and thank you, Pat, for inviting me here tonight. My name is Joe, and I am a compulsive overeater. And the reason that I say that I'm a compulsive overeater is because the condition that I have requires me to overeat, and the overeating is compulsive in nature. So it's not something that I'm just choosing to do because I have nothing else to do or because I'm a bad person. Or because, you know, I'm not trying hard enough. It's a condition I have. And I'll talk a little bit about that as part of my story. I'll tell you a little bit about where I come from with regard to my overeating. I started overeating when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I remember seeing a photograph of myself at the age of 8. And I was in a dance recital costume. And I was pudgy. It was very clear that I was pudgy. And at that time in grade school, I was overeating at meals. And when I got into adolescence, the addiction was taking even a stronger hold. I didn't know that I was addicted at the time, but the progression of the condition was showing itself because when I got into my adolescence, I was starting to obsess about food in between meals. I remember being 12 years old in junior high school, and I was in my science class, which was the first class of the day, and it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I remember telling myself, okay, when I get home from school, I'm only going to have a piece of fruit. So at 12 years old, I'm making a commitment, you know, 7 hours ahead of time for what I'm going to do with food. So that was starting to set in at that age. And when I got home that day from school, I couldn't just eat a piece of fruit, I had to go for something else that was more satisfying. And I remember feeling bad that I couldn't keep my resolution. In junior high and adolescence, I was eating food that had, you know, the sugary, salty food. We had this a la carte menu in my school where they would serve you the hot lunch and then you could go back and buy treats afterward. And so now I was doing that, and I was a figure skater when I was a teenager, and I would go to the vending machine as, you know, in between my practices on the ice. And I would hide what I was eating. Because I remember buying one time I bought a big sugary thing out of the vending machine, and I put it in my skating bag, and I hid it in my skating bag until I got home, and then I ate it when I got home in secret. Secretive eating was starting in adolescence. I remember being in high school, waiting out my family to go to bed so that I could stay up at night and eat by myself in private. And I come from a family of six people, so I'm having to wait out five people to go to bed, pretending that I was staying up to do my homework, but really I was staying up so that I could eat. I was a babysitter when I was a teenager. And that was a wonderful opportunity for me to go into the food, because invariably the people that I babysat for had all the good junk in their house. They had sugary stuff and salty stuff and snacks, and they had plenty of it. In my home, my mother was very attentive to nutrition. And so we were eating very nutritious food at meals. We didn't have dessert every night. If we had a dessert, that was like a treat. She did not let us have sugary cereal for breakfast. If she bought sugary cereal, that was for dessert, not for breakfast. So she was very attentive. We didn't have a lot of junk food in our house, which I'm really grateful for. And I really commend her for doing that. What that meant was that when I went to the babysitting clients, I would raid their refrigerator and their pantry, but I would do so in such a way as to hopefully not get found out that that's what I was doing. And when I was babysitting, I enjoyed the kids. I really did. I liked them. We had fun together. But there came a time in the evening when I would start to get anxious for them to go to bed, because when they went to bed, then that was time for me to eat. And so I was always glad when they went to bed, because then that was the real time for me to raid the refrigerator and cabinets, because no one was watching. So this secretive hiding out with food. When I got into college, things were getting even more progressive, because that's what an addiction does. It didn't get progressive because I was in college. It just got progressive because that's just what food addiction does. So in college, the quantities I was eating got bigger and bigger. We had an all-you-can-eat food plan. So you could go through the line, and as long as you were eating it in the cafeteria, you could have however much food you wanted. You could stay in there as long as you wanted. You could have as many servings of the main entree. You could have as many servings of dessert as you wanted. And so that was like a free-for-all. And then, but there were times when I would steal the food and I would hide it in my jacket pocket and abscond with it out of the cafeteria. Also in college, we had a convenience store across the dorm where I was living, and I would go there and get the treats. And there was a bakery in town, and they would open up the back end during overnights when they were baking. They would open up the back door and sell items out the back door. So my college friends and I would go down there and buy that and eat it. I would order when I was living in the dorm, they would make. You could buy a pizza from the front desk, and they would bake it for you, and I would buy it and eat the whole thing. And so, after college, the addiction progressed, because that's what an addiction does. So I had a designated binge night. I didn't call it that, but that's what it was, and it was Saturday night. So I would work. I worked from Tuesday through Saturday. I would get off work at noon on Saturday, and I was just euphoric at noon on Saturday, because that was the time I would go to the grocery store, buy all this junk, bring it home, put it in the refrigerator, throw it on the couch, lie down for a nap. And I would, because I had gotten up real early that day, because my work shift was like from 5 to noon. It was, so I would get up early in the day. And then I'd wake up at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, and then I would proceed to binge in front of the television for the next 8 or 9 hours. And that was my Saturday night. And I was in my early 20s, and I look back on that and feel a little sad, because usually for people when they're in their early 20s, that's their time of sowing their wild oats, dating, having a social life. And I was home alone on Saturday nights binging. So within a number of years, every night was a binge night. I was binging every night. I was waking up with food hangovers every day. Food was taking an increasingly predatory place in my life, where I was thinking about it way more than I ever had. I was planning for it way more than I had stashes of food in my dresser drawer, in my purse. My car was a binge mobile. You couldn't see the floor of the back of my car, because when I was in my car, I would stop at the fast food joints and the gas stations and the grocery stores and the delis, and I would eat in my car, and I would throw the packages in the back seat. So there were cellophane wrappers and boxes and aluminum cans. And I was embarrassed whenever I gave someone a ride, because they would see that in the back of my car. One of the defining features of my food addiction was the secrecy. And so the car was the only place where I had fully guaranteed secrecy. So I ate in my car a lot. I would stop after work. I would stop at at the gas station. And I would buy a bunch of stuff, and I was embarrassed by what I was buying, because I figured, oh, they know what I'm doing with this food. And I would go out to my car. It would be 10 o'clock at night, and I would hide out in the car. I would slam the door shut and lock the doors. Now, I was safe. This was not a safety maneuver that I was doing, but it was more of a like an FU to the universe, you know, stay the hell away, leave me alone, and leave me alone with my food. My highest weight was 254 pounds, and I would like to share a photo of myself. Let's see here, let me. I'll share a photo of myself that was close to my high weight. Let's see. Okay. Oh, can you see what I'm presenting? Can you see the photo?
No, we can't see anything,
Okay, let
Joanna.
me hang on a second. Okay, can you see it
Yes,
now?
we can
Okay.
see it now.
Okay, so this was me. Gosh, I'm getting emotional. This was 30 years ago. And I was at a professional award ceremony, and I'd gotten an award, and that was what I looked like. And I was in so much spiritual pain. I had no idea how much spiritual pain I was in, but you can see by the roundedness of my face, the excess weight. And this was not at my highest weight. But it gives you an idea of the situation, the physical situation that I was in. I worried about my health. I was in that photo, I was, how old was I? I was 33. So I was in my early 30s with this morbid obesity. I mean, I worried about what I was doing to my body with the overeating, because at that weight, I mean, I was well over 200 pounds. I knew that I was putting my health at risk and my life at risk. I knew that I was shortening my life expectancy by what I was doing with food. And there wasn't anything I could do about it. It's the worst place to be suffering and not have anything to do about it. There's a passage in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this is Overeaters Anonymous, but the big book, it's called, well, we call it the big book, but it has instructions for how to recover from an addiction. They wrote it for alcoholics. It's by alcoholics for alcoholics, but I find that the program of recovery in this big book provides me the instructions, and there's identification, like, you know, what does it mean for them to be an alcoholic? This is what it means for me to be a compulsive overeater. This is from page 8. This is from Bill's story. He says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Food was my master. And in that desperate place, I came to Overeaters Anonymous. I did not want to come here. I mean, who wants to come to a 12-step program? First of all, I'm too smart, right? Wink, wink. Yeah, so where did my smarts get me? 254 pounds and unable to stop overeating. But I came here and I was introduced to a fellowship, and then introduced to a program of recovery. And I've learned a great deal spiritually over the years, and I'm still learning, and I will never stop learning spiritually, that is for sure. And I want to say this for the benefit of anyone who's new to Overeaters Anonymous. I want to provide you information about what this addiction is made out of, and what we can do to recover from it. So I have two primary symptoms. One is a physical symptom, and the other is a mental symptom. So, you know, and if you look over your food eating history, you'll probably find what I found, which is there are certain foods that I go for over and over and over again. In my overeating, I was going for things that had sugar in them, like all the things you would find at a bakery, candy, things like that. So would really overeat on things that had sugar, flour. So again, things in a baked, you know, a bakery, chips, pretzels, pasta, breads, things like that. High salt foods like the what is it, the tomato sauce on in pizza, high salt cheeses, high salt meats. I wasn't one to put a lot of salt on the food, like with a salt shaker, but I was eating food that already had high salt in it. High saturated fat, like, you know, I didn't like to smother things with butter, but I would eat things that had butter already in it. And what other kinds of fats? Cheeses, high fat meats, things like that. And then volume of any kind. So a volume of, like, I could overeat If there was nothing else in the house, I would overeat on baby carrots. Now, that would not be my first choice for sure, but if it was the only thing available, I would overeat on that as well. So those are my five like triggers, if you will, the physical triggers, because my body responds to those substances differently than the body of a normal eater. There's a group of us called compulsive overeaters. We are a group. I can't diagnose anybody else, but what I can tell you for sure is there's a group of us. And then you can say whether or not you're part of this group. There's a group, compulsive overeaters, and our bodies are different than the body of a normal eater. Before I got into recovery, I would look at someone who was a normal eater and feel so bad that I couldn't do what they did. And I thought I should be able to do what they did. I'm not able to do that. A normal eater, and I've seen them do this. I mean, I'm sure you have too. And they'll eat a couple of bites of a candy bar and then they'll leave the rest of it. You ever seen anybody do that? Does that look weird? I just don't understand that. That just looks so odd to me. You see them at a restaurant and they won't finish their dessert and they won't take it home in a doggy bag either. That is just, what is that? We call them normal eaters. That doesn't look normal to me. They will be able to go to a deli and they'll spontaneously get a sandwich and they'll eat the sandwich and then they won't want any more. And they'll be satisfied. I don't identify with that. That's not what I do with food. And that's one of the ways that I know I'm a compulsive overeater is because when I look at what normal eaters do, I absolutely cannot identify with it. I have this physical response. So then I then in addition to that, I have a mental response. We call it the what do we call it? The obsession of the mind. So allergy of the body, which is the physical component, obsession of the mind, which is even when I'm
15
not,
minutes.
oh, thank you, Donna. Even when I'm not overeating, and I'm not eating those trigger foods, I'm obsessing about those foods or I'm obsessing about something else. And that obsession becomes so painful, I can't stand it. It's mental torture. And I have to shut up the mental torture. So the only way I know how to do that is to overeat. So then I go back into the overeating and the cycle just continues like that over and over. And that's why I could never stick with a diet because the mental obsession was on me. And so that's the those are the symptoms. And then the solution for me is a spiritual solution. So what do we mean, a spiritual solution? Well, I mean, when I first came to OA, I thought of that as it's religious. Oh, you're going to make me into a religious person. And no, that's not what this is. A spiritual solution is not the same thing as a religious approach. It's a spiritual approach. And what I have had to do because the eating was causing me so much pain that I was willing to start paying attention to what you all were telling me. So I found a fellowship, like I said, but I was in the fellowship for a while before I really became open to the program of recovery. The program of recovery has me take these 12 steps. We're a 12-step program, taking these 12 steps. And the 12 steps are a series of spiritual actions that address the bottom line problem, which is a problem that goes on inside of me. So my problem is not the weather. It's not what my parents did. It's not the school I went to. It's not my employer. It's not, where I live. It's not the political environment. It's not my financial situation. It's what is going on inside of me. You've probably heard that saying, it's not what you're eating, it's what's eating you. Well, we take that really seriously. In Overeaters Anonymous, we have a program of recovery that addresses that, that confronts that. And so I have had to undergo a spotlight being turned on inside of me. What are my attitudes? What are my thoughts? What are my resentments? What are my fears? And that process, it's called the inventory process, steps 4 through 9. And that process is designed to clean out this junk that's been living inside of me that I've been eating over all of this time. Because that's what was driving me into the food. Yes, I have an allergy. I respond differently to the foods than a normal eater. But what is sending me back over and over and over? If I know that these foods are foods that I can't stop overeating, how come I can't just make a decision not to eat them? It's because of the mental obsession, which is produced by the spiritual pain. So if I really want freedom from this thing called food addiction, I have to be about the business of addressing the spiritual pain that I'm in, the inner, or if you want to call it, the inner pain that I'm in. And in resolving that inner pain, I'm no longer getting the mental obsession, which then sends me back into the food. I probably won't have time to go through all the steps, but I'll just say, my basically what I w have been allowed to do is to confront the nature of this, first of all, the physical reality. So I follow a very structured food plan today where I'm not eating any of my trigger foods or any of my trigger amounts. I treat my food like prescription medication. I go to a nutritionist and I get my food plan from a nutritionist. I discuss it with my sponsor so that there's full transparency about what I'm doing with food, so that there's no loophole in what I'm doing with food. There just cannot be any loophole. My addiction is very aggressive and it needs a very aggressive approach to recovery, and this is part of that for me. I'm not on a diet. I will never be on a diet for as long as I live because diets are painful. But also I will say that not being on a diet is not an excuse not to become fully abstinent and follow the fully abstinent food plan, because that's an extension of my step one. So step one says we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. And so my unmanageability around food requires a very direct, structured approach to food itself. And then now that the food is down, now that I'm not overeating at all, now the whole rest of the program is about, now what am I going to do? Now the things that I used to overeat over are coming up to the surface. And so what do I do with that? Well, that's what steps 2 through 12 are for, is to address the underlying spiritual malady. So I went through an inventory process and cleared up, we say, cleared up the wreckage of our past. I had to go back and look at what damage I had caused in my relationships through the chaotic behavior I had as the result of having a food addiction. And so one of the radical aspects in my experience of recovery is that I have had to go from blaming other people for everything to taking ownership of my own behavior. And going back and doing things like making amends to my dad for ignoring his retirement. Because I was an adult. It's not like I was 10 years old. I was in my 20s. I ignored his retirement and I made a really fully realized, fully embodied amends to him. It was my first amend. I decided I was going to start with my big ones first. And I did a lot of other amends as well to clear up that wreckage of the past as a way to clear up the wreckage inside of me, that chaos that had been going on inside of me. We talk a lot about the word God in Overeaters Anonymous, and I want to address this, because if there's anybody on this meeting who was like me when I first came to Overeaters Anonymous, I hated the word God. I mean, I hated it with a deep passion, and I hated the word and I hated the idea, because up until then, my exposure to the word God had been very negative. I'd never had a positive exposure to it, and so I was very turned off by that word. And when I was in the middle of my step nine amends, something, this energy had come up inside of me that I had never felt before, I'd never experienced. And it was beautiful and it was whole and it was loving and it was kind and it was reconciling. And it was just all this good energy. And it was only about a year after that that I developed a concept of a power greater than myself. So I first had the experience of this power greater than myself. And then I developed a concept, and it's my concept. It's not anybody else's concept. And so, if you're new and you're worried that there's going to be some ideology imposed on you, there isn't. You get to have your own experience, and then you get to name the experience. And if you never want to use the word God, you don't have to. You can use your own words, because this has to be the process of recovery. While we follow a certain process in order to have recovery, every person has their own very unique individual experience. And with that experience, we get to name our experience. So I want to really assure you of that. And whether you are, if you're a religious person, if you are a skeptic, if you're a doubter, It doesn't matter whatever your belief system coming in here, recovery is available to you because it was available to me. If it's available to me, it's available to everybody. Today, I'm maintaining a 120-pound weight loss. If you saw me walking down the street, you would not think that I was a compulsive overeater because I'm at a healthy weight today. My relationships are far, far, far better than they ever were or ever could be. I'm a much better employee today. I will be at my job for 14 years at the end of August, and I'm going to be retiring at the end of September. And I get to retire in a graceful way. And some of the input that I'm getting from people is like, the head of our department, she said, Joe, I'm going to try not to cry. I mean, because I get to bring my recovery self to my job as the result of recovery. I'm a better neighbor, I'm a better friend. I'm not perfect. I have my challenges. I have my struggles. But the difference between the way I live now and the way I lived when I was an active overeating is profound. And I heard at an OA convention one time, the gentleman said, "Do not judge yourself by where you think you should be, but by whence you came." And when I look at that photograph of myself that I showed you, and then I think of where I'm at today, by whence I came. It is light years from where I came from. And I also want to say that I showed you that picture not to attack or criticize the woman in that photo, but I really honor her because she's the one who got me to Overeaters Anonymous. Life is very different today. My inner life is different today. My outer life is also different because my inner life is different. And I want to tell anyone who's on this meeting who's
5 minutes.
thank you, Donna. If you're doubting whether or not recovery is available to you, I want you to know something. You have the right to know that recovery is available to you. You have the right to that information. You've come to a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, I assume, because, like me, because I was in pain over what I was doing with my eating, you're also in pain. And I want you to know that your pain is valid. I also want you to know that there is no room for shame in the program of recovery of Overeaters Anonymous, nor shame in the fellowship. Shame is what we have before we get here. We're shamed. We're shamed by other people. We are shamed by ourselves. And when we get here, we need to have a shame-free zone so that there is an atmosphere that we can begin to trust. So that we begin to be open to the process of recovery, which is beautiful. It is not comfortable. It is beautiful. It is not convenient. It is life-giving. It is not familiar. It is overwhelmingly good. Everything I have ever been asked to do for my recovery has been doable. And that's another thing I want you to know. Everything that you will ever be asked to do for your recovery will be doable. If I can stay up at 10 o'clock at night and binge my brains out, I can go make amends to the people I've harmed. If I can wake up with food hangovers every day, I can wake up today and make my abstinent breakfast. I can treat people with respect. I can inventory new disturbances. I can sponsor other people. I can go to my home group and be of service. All the energy that I put into compulsive overeating, I can put into recovery from compulsive overeating. And I'll just end with a passage in the big book, which I just love. It's one of my favorite passages. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. And with that, I will pass. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Joanne, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope.